All right, we'll see if I can do this. Appreciate your prayers for my voice, that I can get all the way through this. And then I'll be happy to fellowship afterwards. I didn't say a whole lot ahead of time just to try and save my voice. But with everything that's been going on in the Middle East, I thought this would be a good idea to be able to talk about this. Giving prophecy sermons is always very exciting, and yet it can be overdone, so I want to be very careful with that. I try and give these sermons when I think they're useful for people. I know when things like this happen, people get nervous about what's going on in the world. Just to let you know, I have been in communication with Dr. Garfinkel, who was our DIG supervisor in Israel. He lives in Jerusalem, and he said that Jerusalem is pretty calm. They have had some slight terrorist activities there, a couple of them right by where we were staying when we were there, in fact, by the Damascus Gate. But he said that the situation in the south is rapidly deteriorating, and that's where the dig site is. So they're supposed to have a dig site in January. He's not sure whether that's going to happen or not, but he will keep us informed. But as you all know, the terrorist activities have started to get organized again. This is a picture of the Hamas rockets hitting Israel on the last great day, the day that the Jews call Simchat Torah. They read the Bible, the Torah, the first five books throughout the year, and on Simchat Torah is when they finish reading it. This activity that happened was something that I think took them by surprise. Supposedly they had some advance warning. Supposedly the United States had some advance warning, but this seemed to happen without people being able to know ahead of time. We have Hezbollah now starting to attack Israel from the north. Lebanon is also attacking Israel after Hamas invaded the south. And Syria is attacking Israel with mortars. So they are getting it on a four-front battlefield right now. And if you've been watching the news, Prime Minister Netanyahu has promised to exterminate Hamas totally. I saw a cartoon that I almost put up here. The first cell was Hamas shooting rockets into Israel. Second was Hamas shooting rockets into Israel. The third was Hamas shooting rockets into Israel. The fourth was Israel retaliating, with the media saying Israel attacked Gaza today. And that is unfortunately the kind of the state of things right now. It also is a good possibility that Iran may have helped plan these attacks with the aid of some money that unfortunately the U.S. Unfroze. Yesterday, the Palestinians in the West Bank marched in solidarity with Hamas. They called it the Day of Rage, and there have been tensions all over. King Abdullah of Jordan, whom I watch very closely, and you'll see why if you're not familiar with this later on, Jordan will play a significant role in some of the final battles that are going on. And he is concerned that we need to get into peace talks immediately for fear that it will escalate into a wider war in the Middle East. So what does all of this mean for us? I spoke on a related topic of watching world events in May, but again, because of what's going on, I thought it would be a good idea to focus on this. Part of this will be review for those of you that enjoy studying prophecy. I'm going to be going through some things that you probably already know. For those of you that are newer to the church and haven't looked a lot at prophecy in the past, this probably will be new to some of you, and hopefully it will be interesting and will help you understand a little more about what is going on. The media right now is also focused on this, as you can imagine. We know in the book of Daniel it says that knowledge would be increased and information would be running to and fro, and that is more true today than it has ever been. This particular man is so small on my screen I can't see his name, but there is a guy who his name is Ray Dalio. He is a hedge fund man. He's an economist. A lot of the economists in the world now are saying that this war that is happening now has a greater than 50% chance of spreading into a World War III. Now, I think he's overstating that. I don't think that's going to happen. But there is a lot of tension right now in the world. I wanted to quote from this article from Ray Dalio and what he says about this. He says, "It appears to me that the odds of transitioning from the contained conflict to a more uncontained hot world war that includes the major powers have risen from 35% to 50% over the last 2 years." Now, he's talking about Russia-Ukraine. He's talking about things that are happening with North Korea versus South Korea, that there is an overall tension in the world, and he sees this battle starting to focus on a potential world war. "If they spread to other countries, most importantly the major countries, there will be a much more horrific hot world war," he said. "It seems to me that the Israel-Hamas war is another classic unfortunate step toward a more violent and encompassing international war." Like I say, yesterday was a day of rage where a lot of pro-Palestinians had some rallies around the world. And again, while I think that what Mr. Dalio is saying here is premature, lesser things have led to world war. You remember what started World War I? One bullet. One bullet assassinated Archduke Ferdinand and started a world war. The takeaway, I think, from this is that tensions are once again heating up, and it's something that we need to be focused on and prepare. Now, we just came back from the Feast of Tabernacles. We spent 8 days talking about the millennium, talking about the removal of Satan, talking about the great white throne judgment, a time of peace, a time of prosperity, a time of happiness, and we pictured this millennial reign of Jesus Christ. But if you'll remember on trumpets, we also discussed that the return of the Messiah to rule was preceded by the trumpets, by the trumpet plagues, and by a great tribulation and a period of war on the earth. I want to go to Daniel chapter 12, and again, I've got some of the scriptures today, not all of them on the screen. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 1, it says, "At that time," and we'll come back and discuss this in a moment, "Michael will stand up." Michael is the archangel that it protects the people of God. "The great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time your people will be delivered, everyone who's found written in the book. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." Now you look at the second half of this, verse 2 and 3. It talks about a time when the saints are resurrected. That hasn't happened yet. So this isn't an historical lesson. This is a prophetic lesson that was given to Daniel. That at the time when people would be resurrected and brought back to life, it says that preceding that, there would be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. This clearly, then, is an end-time prophecy, a time of trouble so bad that the world has never seen the likes of it. But I want you to notice the first three words of this prophecy. It says, "at that time." So what time is Daniel referring to? What time is the angel, I should say, talking to Daniel, referring to? Where does this end-time calamity start, and when will it start? Now, the when is one of those questions that we like to focus on, and we don't have the direct answers to that. But where and what to look for, we do. And so we'll spend some time today talking about this. Verse 1 of Daniel 12 says, "at that time." To understand "at that time," you've got to understand what preceded this. Remember, there's no chapter breaks in the original writings of the Bible. The book of Daniel was simply one long letter or one long book. So we go back to chapter 11 to see what it was he was talking about at that time. There is an article on Life Open Truth that goes through Daniel 11. If you haven't read this for a while, I would encourage you to do so. This is what Daniel chapter 11, to me, proves prophecy and proves that the Bible is accurate, because it goes through 2,300 years of history and it details every world leader from the king of the north and the king of the south all the way down to modern times. So Daniel 11, again, is an account of two competing forces. It talks about a king of the north and a king of the south. Over 2,300 years, that obviously has changed. Leaders come and go. The whole chapter starts with the kingdom of Alexander the Great around 300 BC and takes us right up to modern times today. This chapter details the life and death of the leaders of these two superpowers. It goes through and talks about how they will reign, how they will be defeated, if they're going to be killed or poisoned. There's just so many details in this. It really is an amazing article. Would really encourage you to go back and read this. Our article explains more about it. I won't get into the details of the historical aspects of it, but it does cover a range of prophecies. So from verse 1 to verse 39, it details from the start of Alexander the Great through the last conquest that we have seen, which was the Roman Empire taking over as the king of the north. So verse 1 through 39 are historical. That has all happened. Many scholars agree with this, by the way. Expositors, Bible commentary goes right down the line. From verse 1 through verse 39, history can follow exactly what was said here, and this was written long before Alexander the Great ever came around. Again, wonderful prophetic opportunities here. But verse 40 on is prophetic. It hasn't happened yet. So what I want to do is focus on verse 40 on to see what it is that we're going to be looking for as some of these battles start to rage. The final king of the north and the final king of the south will clash in a final battle. So let's go to Daniel chapter 11 and let's start in verse 40 while I get a drink. Thank you, Mr. Chasson, for the tea. Tea with lemon. Verse 40. At the time of the end, so now we're talking about something that hasn't happened yet. This is prophetic. This is right before when Daniel chapter 12 says there's going to be a time of trouble right before a resurrection. This is all focused right at the very end. At the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him, the king of the north. And the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he will enter the countries and overwhelm them and pass through. When you read through this, you recognize the fact that there are, again, as has been in the last 2,300 years, two superpowers in the European and Middle East theater, a king of the north and a king of the south. The last king of the north was the Roman Empire that took over. And we know, again, from prophecy that this king of the north will be a European conflagration of armies. So the king of the south is going to attack him. The king of the north is going to come against him like a whirlwind. Verse 41, he will also, this is the king of the north, enter the glorious land. This is talking about the land of Israel. And many countries will be overthrown, but these will escape out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. If you look at a map and you look at where Edom, Moab, and Ammon was, that is the modern-day nation of Jordan. Jordan will escape this. That's why I say watching Jordan is also very interesting to me. They are pro-Palestinian, but they also have a neutrality in the area that is probably a bad example, but it reminds me somewhat of Switzerland in World War II. Where they try to do their best to keep neutral, even though they do have their views on it. So this European superpower, this king of the north, will push back at the king of the south, will overthrow various countries. Verse 42, he will stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. So this European superpower is going to head south because of whatever is happening. As the king of the south is pushing against the rest of Europe, Europe is going to take matters into their own hands. Interesting to me that there's nothing in here about what we would consider the United States being a part of this final battle. Verse 42, he will stretch out his 43, and he will have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. The Libyans and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. So as he's doing this, as he's coming down, I get the feeling, this is me now, I get the feeling that the king of the south gets wiped out. You don't hear about the king of the south from here on out. All the rest of the prophecies talk about what's going to happen with the king of the north, with the beast power, with the false prophet. The king of the south pushes against him. The king of the north comes, and it appears that this Arab union will be destroyed at this time. So as he is now, he's entered the glorious land. He's gone all the way into Egypt, verse 42. But news from the east and the north will trouble him. From the perspective of Israel, east and north would probably be Russia and China. And we know that Russia, China, and North Korea have been making a lot of waves lately as well. But news from the east and the north will trouble him. Therefore, he will go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. So he's going to be fighting a lot of battles on a lot of fronts. The first battle is going to be into the Holy Land and attacking the king of the south, and then taking on the powers to the northeast. Verse 45, he will plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to an end, and no one will help. You know, again, I say we don't hear anything more about the king of the south after this prophecy, but we know that the king of the north will be in the Holy Land and will take over before news out of the northeast will cause him to stop this. In the end, it would appear that both the king of the north and the king of the south will not succeed, but the turmoil will escalate. Then, we get into chapter 12, where it discusses the safety for the people of God during a time of great trial. What I want to do for the next little bit, and there's kind of two sections left to the sermon, I want to go through and talk about why there is an Arab-Israeli conflict to start with. Personal opinion, it would appear, and you'll see this in some prophecies, that it will be the conflict in the Middle East that will cause the king of the south to come together and will cause the king of the north to finally get together. You remember in Daniel, if you remember studying this, where it talks about that the final resurrection of this king of the north, it says, will have toes partly of clay and partly of iron, that they won't mix very well. When you look at European countries right now, they don't really mix well. They don't trust each other. Germany came out of World War II, did a lot of damage to France, did a lot of damage to Poland, to Austria, and the German superpower that was behind this, there's some doubts in people's minds. They're not really gelled. Something's going to happen to bring them together. And we will review that as we go. But what I want to do is take a little bit of time now and review why there is this problem between the Palestinians and the Jews. Most of them, I don't think, even completely realize the problems and how far back they go. So I'm going to talk, we're going to go all the way back to Abraham, which we'll discuss next, and then we'll talk about more modern times, how things have happened. Because some of these sections are long, I'm not going to put these up on the screen, but I want to start with Genesis chapter 16. If you would turn with me back to Genesis 16. Here's the first event that starts to put a conflict between two peoples. Genesis 16, we're going to start in verse 1, and you can see the picture here. This is Sarah and Abraham, and Sarah giving Hagar to Abraham. Now, verse 1, now Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid, perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abram heeded the voice of Sarah. Sarai, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. And Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar, she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. Abraham now has two wives, one of what I will call a Hebrew background through Abraham's family. But now she's married an Egyptian. This is a different peoples. And now there's enmity between them. Sarah thinks she's going to be happy having a child. But as soon as Hagar gets pregnant, she now despises Sarah, and there's going to start a conflict between these two people. Verse 6. So Abram said to Sarai, "Indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do with her as you please." And Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her presence. So the animosity now is going to start to develop between two families that will come out of the loins of Abraham. Verse 7. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur, and he said to her, "Hagar, where have you come from and where are you going?" And she fled, said, "I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai." And here's a promise from God to the descendants of Ishmael. The angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit yourself to her." The angel said to her, "I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they will not be able to be counted for number." So there's going to come a great group of people out of Ishmael. And the start of this between Ishmael and what will become the son of Sarah, Isaac, there's going to be contention. "For behold, you are with child. You will bear a son and call his name Ishmael." Notice verse 12. "He will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand will be against him, and he will dwell in the presence of his brethren." So these two groups that are going to grow up are going to grow up in the presence of each other. They're going to grow up together. But he's going to be a wild man, and he's going to be against everyone. And so this contention that's going on in the Middle East now stems all the way back to the time of Abraham. Even though the present-day people probably don't realize it, it is ingrained in them to distrust each other. And again, we'll see more as we go on. All right, next, Genesis chapter 17. Let's go forward. Now we have God giving a promise to Abraham and to Sarah. When Abraham was 99 years old, every time I read this, I shudder. I don't know why. He appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly." Now, at this point in time, I'm imagining Abram is, because there's no mention of Sarah yet, Ishmael is going to be already been prophesied to be a huge nation that you can't even count the number because there's going to be so many, and he's probably thinking this is where it's going. Abraham fell on his face and talked with them, saying, "As for me, my Lord, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations." Okay, that maybe that was a little bit confusing to him because he's only got one son. "And kings will come from you, and I will establish my covenant," verse 7, "between me and you and your descendants after you and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. Also, I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession. I will be their God." So not only are there going to be two groups of people, which we'll see in a minute, but one of them is going to take over the land of Canaan, and the other group is going to feel like they got cheated out of that land. We'll see that as we go. It again helps us understand. God promised Abraham his descendants would be great. Again, at this time, I would imagine Abraham is thinking that God is referring to Ishmael. Look at verse 15. Abraham, and then God said to Abraham, "As for Sarah, your wife, you will not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, and I will bless her, and I will give you a son by her, and then I will bless her, and she will be a mother of nations, kings, and many people." And Abraham falls on his face and laughs at age 99. Falling on your face probably is a pretty tough thing to do as well, but he did. "Shall a child be born to a man who's 100 years old, and Sarah who is 90 years old?" And then look at this interesting statement. Abraham says to God, "Let Ishmael be the one. Oh, that Ishmael would live before you. I don't need another son. I've got one. Let's just give it all to Ishmael." So Abraham now is concerned about this. Verse 19, God says, "No, Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you will call his name Isaac." Now, as we go through this and we understand this even more, we recognize the fact that as Abraham has this relationship with Ishmael, God is going to create a covenant, and that covenant is going to be through Isaac. Verse 20, as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him. I will make him fruitful. I will multiply him. He will beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. And he finished talking with him, and God went up from Abraham. So as we look at this, we recognize the fact that what Abraham is now seeing is his firstborn, which he would consider Isaac, Ishmael, is not going to get the covenant. The covenant is going to go, as it were, from Abraham's perspective, to his secondborn. But from Sarah's perspective, it's her firstborn, because it was the baby that she would have. This firstborn, again, doesn't get the promises of the covenant. This is the first of several events that would separate these relatives, and we'll see this. To this day, the Muslims believe that the promises went to Ishmael. I don't know if you realize that or not. I'll show you a quote from the Quran here in just a moment as we talk through this. There is contention from this moment on. All right, Genesis chapter 21. Ishmael now is in the wilderness. Genesis 21. And starting in verse 8, I won't read a lot of this for the sake of time, but I will remind you of what this says. Sarah now sends Hagar and Ishmael into the wilderness and cast them out. Verse 12, God says to Abraham, don't let this be displeasing in your sight. Do what Sarah has said. And so when Abraham gets up the next morning, he gives Hagar and Ishmael some bread and water and sends them away. While they're out, God then talks to Hagar and says, I will make your son a great nation. Verse 19, then God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water, and she filled the skin with water and gave the lad Ishmael to drink. So God was with the lad, and he grew, and he dwelt in the wilderness, and he became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So now we've got this coming from Abraham. Hagar is an Egyptian. Hagar gets Ishmael an Egyptian wife. So these two people genetically are related, but they're starting to separate into what we would know as Hebrew people and Arab people. It starts all the way back here. Ishmael then marries this Egyptian, lives in the wilderness of Paran. So as we look through this, I want to ask some questions. What lessons, now this is somewhat speculative, but as Hagar is raising Ishmael in the wilderness, what do you suppose Hagar might be telling Ishmael about his ancestry? Here's some things that I think he probably has taught. God promised you an inheritance, and that's true, God did. God told Hagar, you're going to be a great nation, you're going to have 12 princes, you're going to do great things. But Isaac claimed it for himself, and we'll see that as we go forward too. So you should have gotten it all, Ishmael, but Isaac came along and he usurped it. He stole it from you. Third, you, Ishmael, were cheated out of your rightful place in Abraham's fortune. Ishmael was the firstborn. The firstborn is supposed to get the inheritance, and it didn't go to him. Through God's divine intervention, it went to Isaac, who was not, from Hagar's position, was not the firstborn. The stories, she says, that they tell of Isaac are really your stories. I want to read this. This is from the Quran. If you've never seen this, I think this is interesting. This is similar to the story in the Hebrew Bible. This is about Abraham sacrificing his son. So here's what the Quran says. O my Lord, grant me a righteous son. So we gave him the good news of a boy ready to suffer and forbear. See, Isaac or Ishmael would be one who would suffer. Now, he would be sent out into the wilderness. He would be kicked out of the family. Then when the son reached the age of serious work, he said, O my son, I see in a vision that I offer you in sacrifice. Now see what is your view. And the son said, O my father, do as you are commanded. Sounds familiar? Remember, Isaac basically said the same thing. But in the Quran, they're not talking about Isaac. They're talking about Ishmael. So in the Quran, Ishmael is the one that Abraham tried to sacrifice. Thou wilt find me, if Allah so wills, one practicing patience and consistency. So when they had both submitted their wills to Allah, and he had laid them prostrate on his forehead for sacrifice, we, the God, called out to him and said, O Abraham, thou hast already fulfilled the vision. Thus indeed we do reward those who go right. For this was obviously a trial, and we ransomed him with a momentous sacrifice. So the Quran says that Abraham sacrificed Ishmael. The Hebrew scriptures say that Abraham sacrificed Isaac. And these stories are now convoluted. You have probably Hagar teaching Ishmael, this was your rightful thing and it was usurped. And those stories are really about you. And Abraham, through Isaac, is saying, no, you had the right to this because God told me. And these stories are really about Isaac. The descendants of Ishmael, it talks about where they were. And again, I won't turn there, but in Genesis 25, it says they dwelt in Havilah to Shur, east of Egypt. That is the modern-day nation of Saudi Arabia. So that's where the Ishmaelites resided. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you've been watching the news in the last month versus the last day, Saudi Arabia was trying to do a peace agreement with Israel. This is Ishmael trying to have an agreement with Isaac, right? And they had started down that path. But as soon as the Hamas thing happened, what did Saudi Arabia say just yesterday? We're backing out of this peace deal because we have to back Hamas. And so the idea of this peace that we were looking at and hopeful, it evaporated overnight because of what is going on. Saudi Arabia, of note, again, was trying to establish peace with Israel, and we'll see where this lands in the future. All right, now let's go forward another generation. We have two twins that are going to be born. Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25, the birth of two nations. So we have Ishmael already out on his own. So the story of Ishmael and Isaac are separate now. We've got two lines that are starting. Ishmael's out on his own. We're still in the Isaac line, but you're going to see something happen that I think is interesting. Genesis chapter 25 and verse 21. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children, there were twins, struggled together within her. And she said, if all is well, why am I like this? So she went to inquire of the Lord. And here's a prophecy that God gives about the two boys that are being raised in Rebekah's womb. Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples will be separated from your body. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. You think that's going to be contentious? You know it will. I've not been around twins to know. Perhaps they get along great, perhaps they fight. But these two twins were going to be very different peoples. And it even says that one came out looking different than the other. They were very different personalities. Verse 24, when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, and he was hairy. He was like a hairy garment all over, and they called his name Esau. And afterward, his brother came out, and his brother took hold of his brother's heel. It's like, no, you're not. You're not going to be first. I'm going to be first. And there's contention even from the womb. They struggled together. So his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when he bore them. Both boys grew. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. And here's another problem. Isaac loved Esau, and Rebekah loved Jacob. So now we've got two parents that one favors one kid and one favors the other. Esau was the firstborn, but the prophecy said that the firstborn would serve the younger. Verse 29. Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Isaac came from the field, for he was weary. And Esau came in from the field and was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me with some of that red stew, for I am weary. Therefore his name was called Edom, which means red. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, "Look, I'm about to die, so what is this birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear it to me." So he swore it, and he sold his birthright for stew and some bread. So now there's even further contention. What should have gone to the firstborn has now been promised to go to the secondborn, because Esau at that point in time thought, "What if I'm about to die, what good is a birthright going to be, because I'm about to die?" So he sells it. In my opinion, both boys were wrong. Isaac shouldn't have tried this. I think the promise to Isaac would have been there. God would have found a way. Perhaps God looked into the future and saw that sneaky Jacob would do this. I don't know. But anyway, we have now this first split between the boys where one of them has now purchased a birthright from the other. Chapter 26. Chapter 26. Again, I will just read this. You don't have to turn here. Starting in verse 34 and 35. It says, "When Esau was 40 years old, he took as wives Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah." Further separation here. So Isaac now has two sons, twins. One of them is going to get the birthright. He's going to be given all of the promises that goes through Jacob. Esau is now separating himself, as it were, from the family over a lot of irritation between what's going on, and he marries Canaanite women. So we have Ishmael already out there. Now we have Esau heading that direction, and there's going to be another schism here. Finally, in chapter 27, in verse 1, we see the final blow here. "It came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim that he couldn't see that he called Esau and said to him, 'My son,' and he answered, 'Here I am.' He said, 'Behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now therefore take your weapons, your quiver, your bow, go out to the field and hunt game, and make me a savory food such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat it, and that my soul may bless you.'" It was his desire to give the firstborn blessing to Esau. Now Rebekah, verse 5, was listening when Isaac spoke to Esau, and Esau went to the field to hunt. So Rebekah spoke to Jacob and said, and again I'll summarize here, "I want you to go in and pretend to be Esau so God will bless you, or so Abraham will bless you, or Isaac will bless you." Sorry, my sickness has taken over here. And Jacob rightly says, "I'm not hairy like my brother." "Well, go get some sheepskin and we'll put it on you." Is this where the term wolf in sheep's clothing comes from? I don't know. But the bottom line is they fool Abraham, and Isaac now blesses the wrong boy from his perspective. So not only did he lose the birthright, he's now also lost the blessing. And Esau gets very angry to the place where he says, "I'm going to kill my brother." And Jacob gets sent away. So Jacob steals the birthright. Jacob steals the blessing. It all is, from Esau's perspective, an absolute travesty. The second time now that an inheritance is usurped from the firstborn, and it will just continue to go on. Verse 30, let me just read this real quick. "Now it happened as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob that Jacob had scarcely gone from the presence of Isaac his father when Esau came in and asked for the blessing." Notice what it is that Isaac said would happen to him. Esau, when he hears these words, cries bitterly and says, "Bless me also." But Isaac says to him, "Your brother came with deceit and has taken your blessing." And Esau says, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times." So here's the blessing that Isaac gives to Esau. "Behold," this is in verse 39, "Behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth." Other translations say away from the fatness of the earth. This is not a good thing. This is almost a curse. "And of the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you will live." So these people that would come from Esau would be a warlike people. "And you will serve your brother." and there would be this contention between them. But it will come to pass when you become restless that you will break his yoke from your neck. So this is a prophecy that the descendants of Esau would be in conflict with the descendants of Jacob. And that, again, is where we understand when you look at where Esau went, when you look at where Ishmael went, when you look at the marriage between them, you see that these Arab peoples, through Ishmael and through Esau, have become the Arab states of today. Jacob now has become a part of what we consider Israel. And since the 10 tribes left, it's basically just Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. Jacob then marries, or Esau, sorry, then marries also into the line of Ishmael in Genesis 28. So not only does he have Hittite wives, but he now has wives from Ishmael and further distances himself from Abraham's descendants. And now the Esau and Ishmael lines form an alliance. Esau then settles in the land of Seir and Edom. That's kind of south of Jordan, not quite into Saudi Arabia, but down in that area, and starts to take over in that land. So that's a background. I want to just show you this quick picture. This is what God promised as an inheritance to Abraham. So you see Syria up in the north, Lebanon, part of Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, and even down into Egypt. These are areas that were given to Ishmael and Esau. And notice where Jacob's descendants go. That little tiny spot. I don't know if my thing is still on here. Yeah. That little spot right there. So what we see is Jacob gets a very small territory, and he is surrounded by his brothers slash cousins. And there's contention between them. Now, you talk about deep-seated, inbred hostility. I again, don't think that a lot of them even realize why that's there, but children are brought up and taught by their parents. These people are bad people. These people are good people. And we'll see that even further as we go. I really don't believe that a lot of them even realize what's happening. But Israel, through the promises of God, after coming out of Egyptian slavery, were given a relatively small piece of the inheritance of Abraham. All right. So now let's start to understand what happens in modern times. So now we're going to start from 1948 forward. And I know history lessons can be boring for some, but just bear with me, just to understand what has happened in recent times. So you've got this deep-seated thing, but there also is a lot of stuff that has happened recently from 1948 on to help even further cause this mitigated conflict between the two. So the first one happens right after World War II. The United Nations steps in. The United Nations, my opinion, should be disbanded. They've served their purpose, and they are a mess. But they step in 1948 with Resolution 181. Resolution 181 sought to divide the British mandate of Palestine into Arab and Jewish states. So everybody agreed, okay, well, we're going to have an Arab portion, and we're going to have an Israeli portion, kind of a two-state solution, and we'll both live in peace. There's a problem with that. The parties that agreed to it ended up backing out in the, and again, if you don't know history, this won't make any sense. There's a Sykes-Picot agreement where they were supposed to get certain land, and the signers of the document then, after they signed the document, said, yeah, we were just kidding, and basically took everything away from what the Arabs were supposed to get. May 14th, 1948, the Nation of Israel is created, which further irritates the Arabs around them. And it sparks the first Arab-Israeli war. 1948, Israel won that war in 1949. 750,000 Palestinians were displaced. This is in the history. This is in the memory of the grandparents of people that are out there today. A lot of those displaced people went to Jordan, and Jordan accepted them. The region was broken up into three parts, and you can see it here. You have Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. And if you're not familiar with this, I want you to understand, this is the West Bank, and this is Gaza, right here. And then all of the area that's kind of this blue-green or teal color, that is what is in possession of Israel right now. This was what was drawn up in 1948. 1956, Israel invades the Sinai Peninsula, called the Suez Crisis, and tries to take over land that belonged to Egypt. So Israel, and why they want that land, I don't know. I've been there. It is nothing but death and desert. But for some reason, they decided that they wanted to take over this. Now, again, if you look back at what God promised to the nations, the 10 tribes of Israel, it did extend all the way down to Egypt. So perhaps in the Israelis' minds, this was land that God promised to us, and we aren't in possession of it right now, so we're going to go down and take it. So Israel invades the Sinai Peninsula. Later on in 1967, they have the Six-Day War. This is something that Israel initiated, and they tried to take control of the Sinai Peninsula and Gaza from Egypt. So you see this kind of L-shaped thing down in the bottom. Gaza ended up just being a small strip, and the rest of it then went back to Israel. Further irritating the Arabs and the Israelis together. 1973, we have the infamous Yom Kippur War. I think the Arabs thought we were going to catch them when they're fasting because they're going to be weak. And I find it interesting that they also attacked on the last day, on the last great day of the feast. Thinking that a lot of them would be in religious practices during that time. We have the Yom Kippur War. Egypt and Syria attack Israel on the Day of Atonement. So Egypt from the south, Syria from the north. The majority of the battle was for control of the Sinai in the south and the Golan Heights in the very north. The Golan Heights is up here, right here. So you've got the Sinai and you've got the Golan Heights. That's what the Yom Kippur War was about. The battle fixed two opposing positions in the region. The Arabs felt emboldened to try and push at Israel, and Israel realized that it must always dominate the Arab states militarily. If you listened, you actually heard Benjamin Netanyahu say that. The world is calling for us to be peaceful, but you cannot be weak in the Middle East. If you do, you'll be crushed, and we have to stand up militarily. They still feel that today. Then we have all of these Arab-Israeli peace accords that happened from 1973 on. You remember Jimmy Carter doing it and Barack Obama doing it and all of these peace accords, the Oslo Accords, trying to get peace between these two people. Let's have a two-state solution. Let's do this, let's do that. And there have been talks, and they have been going on for a long time. The Oslo Accords in 1993 and I'm quoting now from that accord, the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. They wanted to have their own country, their own state. But if you look at this, it, in a lot of ways it's untenable because Gaza is one part and the West Bank is another part, and they would be separated by Israel and a huge wall. If you remember me showing you what that wall looked like, it's 30, 40 feet high with razor wire on the top. Tough to have a country that is separated by an enemy. And so this two-state solution isn't going to work out for them. Between 2000 and 2005, it's called the Second Intifada, where Israel builds a wall to isolate the West Bank from Israel. There's battles going back and forth, and the situation never did completely get resolved. But in 2006, a group comes along called Hamas. Now, you've seen them a lot in the newspaper. In a lot of ways, this is an extension of ISIS, but they become an official group, and they win Palestinian authorities' primary elections and gain control of the Gaza Strip. So they started out as a political party, I would say maybe perhaps not unlike Adolf Hitler, who started out in politics to start with, and then once they got into that, then they recognized we now have control of Gaza. We have a lot of people. We have a lot of angst in the area. let's do what we can to attack Israel. In 2015, Israel pushes back. Palestine is no longer recognized by the Oslo Accords, and the turmoil starts to heat up again. So from 2015 on, there is this continuing conflict in the area. 2021, Palestinians are evicted from their homes as Israel pushes to reclaim territory. You may not know about this, but what Israel is doing in the area is they're going just over the border of what, you know, between, say, Israel and the West Bank, and they'll go into a community and they'll kick the Arabs out and they'll take over and they'll start building a village or a kibbutz or a town. They're slowly encroaching on Palestinian territory. Again, from the Jewish perspective, God gave us this land and we should have kicked you out before and didn't do it, but we'll do it now. And from the Arab perspective, we were here, you know, when you were gone and in Europe and wherever, you know, you came back in 1948, but we were already here. Now you're taking our land. So by 2015, we have this. That brings us up to today. This is Israel shelling Gaza City just a couple of days ago. The conflict that is going on between them is palpable right now. So these ongoing tensions have been under the surface for centuries. Both Israel and Palestine desire the same land as their homeland. Some are willing to have a two-state solution, but others say Israel should get it all, and others say that Palestine should get it all. Israel, again, claims it based on God's promises and the 1948 remapping of the region, but the Palestinians see this as an incursion by a foreign enemy. And the fact that Iran is involved doesn't help. All right, now what I want to do is switch to the last part of the sermon, and that's end-time prophecies. So what does the Bible say is going to happen in this region as we know these prophecies are going to happen? So let's start with Zechariah chapter 12. And I would encourage you to turn to these if you've got a Bible in your lap. It's good to actually be reading these. Zechariah chapter 12. I may make it through this with a voice. Zechariah chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. The burden of the word of the Lord against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples, when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. And it will happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut to pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. You can start to see that happen right now, can't you? You've got the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. You've got problems in the West Bank. There have been terrorist activities in the West Bank, even in Jerusalem itself. You've got Lebanon and Syria that are attacking from the north. You've got Iran that is talking about the death of Israel. This goes back to, I think this was in 2020, but you see a picture here of Iran talking about death to Israel. There was one point in time where they were in their parliament or whatever they call it, and they all stood up and they all started chanting, "Death to Israel, death to Israel, death to Israel." The peoples of this area do not want the Jews to survive. And God says all of the nations that try and come up against Jerusalem, it says that Jerusalem will be a heavy stone for all peoples. So we know that there will be a Jewish presence in the area around Jerusalem. We know that this will be an area where the final battle between the king of the north and the king of the south will occur. Mr. Capo did an article recently on this, and I want to quote one of the things he said. It says, while Jordan and Egypt have since made formal peace agreements with the state of Israel, terrorist organizations like ISIS and now Hamas and many nations fail to recognize the legitimacy of Israel's existence. They remain committed to Israel's extermination. And you can see that here when Iran is shouting death to Israel. Psalm chapter 83. Psalm 83, verses 2 through 8. This is another prophecy that God gave about the Jewish people living at that time. says, "For behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head, and they have taken crafty counsel against your people." You can see that happening again today. "They've consulted together against your sheltered ones, and they have said, 'Come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.'" Precisely what is happening today. They are trying to exterminate the nation of Israel. They're trying to wipe them off the face of the earth. I don't want to get too graphic here. We don't have really young kids in the audience, but maybe online, some of the atrocities that happened by Hamas when they went over the border to children and babies. This isn't a polite war. This is a war of trying to cut the remembrance of Israel off. Verse 5, "For they consulted together with one consent, and they formed a confederacy against you." Now, this to me is prophetic of a king of the south that is going to come together. They have done it in the past through Turks, through the Ottoman Empire, through various caliphates that have come along to try and organize these southern Arab nations into a confederation that would push against Israel. "They formed a confederacy against you." Verse 6, "The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, the Moabites, the Hagarites," and it goes on and talks about a lot of them, "Philistia, the Tyre, inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria will also join with them. They have help from the children of Lot. Deal with them as with Midian, as with Sisera, as with Jabin, etc., who perished at Endor, because who became as refuge on the earth." When we look at what is happening here, we recognize that the name of Israel is trying to be pushed out to where there are no more. The problem is, and I say problem, God has promised them that they will keep that land and they will get it back. But this animosity between these two peoples that came through the seed of Abraham, the Quran goes back to Abraham and the Hebrew scriptures go back to Abraham, but the contention between them is so strong. And we see this list of nations that will fight against Israel, and we will see that conflict today. I put this up here just to remind you that it isn't just Israel. It isn't just Judah that they're after. It says, "After Saturday comes Sunday." I just want to read a little bit of this. It says, "In the Middle East, neighbors warned Christians, 'After Saturday comes Sunday.' It means that after we finish the Saturday people, the Jews, we will finish you, the Sunday people." If you look at in Iran right now, during the Day of Rage, what did Iran do? They burnt Jewish flags and they burnt American flags because they know that America and even many nations in Europe are behind the Jewish state. The final battle is yet to be fought. The king of the south will come against and push at Israel in order to try and destabilize the power behind the Jewish state, which will eventually become the king of the north and the European empire. Let's finally turn to Luke 21, and I put this one up here so you can follow along with me. This is what we see is going to happen as the end starts to draw near. So there's a lot of war going on right now. Will it escalate into a bigger conflict? That's possible. Could it escalate into a world war? It's possible. Could it escalate into the final war? It's possible. I don't know. A part of me thinks that this will settle back down, at least for a while, but we'll see. But notice what this is what Jesus Christ said in the Olivet Prophecy. Luke 21, verse 20. "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies." Now, Jerusalem isn't surrounded right now. This is mostly around Gaza and around the north part of Israel. But there are hints of it spreading further. "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that its desolation is near." This did occur in 70 AD, and a part of this prophecy was fulfilled in 70 AD when the Romans destroyed the temple. But it goes on to talk about the fact that this is an end-time event, which you'll see in verse 22. Starting in verse 21, "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let those who are in the let not those who are in the country enter her." I wonder if the people, I know United had a feast site over there, I wonder if they were reading this scripture, "Try not and flee on the Sabbath," and the Sabbath was when it started. I think a lot of them ended up going into Jordan and taking a flight back home. I know that there are still people trapped in Guatemala. This is a very unhappy earth right now, and I think a very unhappy Satan. Verse 22, for these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who have nursing babies in those days, for there will be a great distress in the land and wrath upon the people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captives into all nations. We saw a bit of that, falling by the sword and then being taken captive. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. This south will push against and probably invade Israel, to where the king of the north is going to have to come back and battle. Is this the final war? Not yet. We don't have a king of the north and a king of the south yet. They have yet to be formed and to become powerful. But this is a precursor to it, and I don't think it's going to get any better. The tensions in the region are not going to disappear. So what do we do as we look at the king of the north? European defense spending is no longer a laughing matter. This is a 2023 article. When Russia invaded Ukraine, and now this Hamas battle, Europe is recognizing the fact that they need to be protectorates of the region. The United States is kind of weak right now, and they're not doing a lot. So Europe is now getting to the place where they're recognizing that they need to do this. If you can see the subtitle here, 2023 will bring with it an expectation that Germany and a collection of 19 other NATO countries that committed to increased defense spending after Russia invaded Ukraine act on those plans. Germany will be at the center of this. Once again, the King of the North will develop. We need to watch what Europe is doing as it demands to play a more prominent role in its own future. The Russia-Ukraine thing was a wake-up call. I think what's happening now with Hamas in the Middle East is going to further push that need for them to be together. King of the South, Erdogan of Turkey to Israel, Islamic world should unite against Israeli attacks. This again is from April of 2023. The nations that surround Israel are saying that they need to unite together to be able to push against this Israeli state. Turkey has called for it. Just like Europe, I think we see the seeds of a union that have been around for decades. There's been a lot of fighting amongst the Shiites and the Sunnis and a lot of Islam area. Something's going to happen to be able to put that aside. There's a lot of infighting in Europe right now between the various countries. Things will happen that will help them to put that aside, and we will have a king of the north and a king of the south. We'll end with this scripture, Mark 13, verse 28 through 31. It says, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branches become tender and puts forth leaves, know that summer is near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that it is near at the door. What things are happening? What things was he talking about here? Again, this is the Olivet Prophecy. Armies surrounding Jerusalem. Wars against nation against nation. Pestilence, earthquakes, things that are happening. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. He concluded the Olivet Prophecy with this admonition. We have to watch. We have to look at what's happening. We've been told what to look for. And we're not looking at fig trees. We're looking at world events. But I have to say, not only do we know what to be looking for, but we also need to be making sure that we have ourselves ready. And we've talked a lot about that, getting ourselves ready. While we wait, while we grow spiritually, we have to watch. I don't know about you, but I think I see fig leaves.